2020 is a year we won't soon forget, though many of us might want to. From the impeachment of a president through the pandemic into the election of 2020, the year has seen more than its fair share of narratives. This week's guest helps us make sense of them all and name our 2020 Story of the Year. She's Dr. Evelyn Farkas this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Joining me as he does every week is my great friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week we talk about big issues with great guests, storytellers, novelists, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories shaping public life in the United States. This week, we're taking a look back at 2020 and announcing our Story of the Year with our great friend, Dr. Evelyn Farkas, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and a recent congressional candidate in her home state of New York. Evelyn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We look back at 2020, and it has been sort of the year that felt like a decade. When we look back, the year started, though, with the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. What does it mean that that's only the fourth or fifth biggest story of the year?
Well, it means that when you have a global crisis, it can overcome even a domestic political crisis, because it was pretty big news that the president was impeached. Now, the impeachment itself was interesting because it's sort of, in some people's heads, it's like the second impeachment, because there was the whole Russia gate, which you guys have covered extensively, which many people thought was, you know, in its totality, an impeachable set of offenses. But ultimately, he actually was impeached for his actions vis-a-vis the Ukrainian government. So engaging with the Ukrainian government, trying to get the Ukrainian government to influence our elections, as perhaps the Russians did.
Do you, when you look back at it, you know, you were in the middle of a congressional campaign when the impeachment trial was taking place. Was it something that resonated with voters in your district?
Yes, because voters in my district is the 17th congressional district in New York. I am a failed congressional candidate, so I ran in the primary in June, and I lost. But my district is a very solidly Democratic district. We will send a Democrat. We are sending a Democrat to Congress for the next Congress. And people there really did vote. It was very much, even for those who are not Democrats, so post-primary, very much a vote against Trump. And I would say it's a very educated electorate right outside of New York City. Rockland and Westchester counties also relatively affluent, although there's quite an income discrepancy there as well, as you have across America. But for people there, it was something that was important, and it galvanized a lot of people into politics. We have whole movements that were started across our country and are very strong in New York among women and minorities in particular, people who have been really, as I said, galvanized by Donald Trump and the need to oppose his policies, which they saw as, you know, anti-women's rights, anti-gay, lesbian, you know, LGBTQ rights, anti-immigration. We also have a lot of immigrants in New York. So the impeachment was important. But of course, as soon as you had the pandemic, things changed.
So some of President Trump's defenders say that he was distracted from the coming pandemic because of the impeachment trial. Do you put any stock in that as an explanation for why he was rather slow to come around on that?
Well, you know, I just read, Rage by Bob Woodward, his latest book, which covers this time period very much in detail. And he demonstrates that, yes, the president was distracted by the impeachment, but not entirely. I mean, he was given a warning and he conveyed to Bob Woodward on the telephone at the time how serious the virus was, that it could spread through the air. So you didn't have to actually touch someone to get it. So it was highly infectious, and that there was a lot of concern inside the administration about it. So the president knew, and, you know, and the distraction, the overlap in time, yes, there was an overlap, but it wasn't enough to excuse the president from his responsibilities. And it was very clear that there were things he could have done all along, even in these interviews, which were, again, happening at the time. The reporter was asking him, well, why don't you do more to get, you know, personal protective PPE, you know, equipment out to people across America who need it. You know, we're seeing that on the news. So there were already questions being asked of him, pressing by reporters at the time in private and, of course, as we saw in public.
So what is the legacy of the impeachment trial now and I guess going forward when historians look back at that trial?
I think they will look back and they will say, here was somebody who became president as a way of, I guess, a backlash maybe against, in part against President Obama, in part, frankly, against the failure of not just President Obama, but all politicians really to address the people, the individual people and the people on Main Street who were the quote unquote losers, the economic losers of the 2008 financial crisis. The fact that we were unable, America, our country was unable to address the growing divide in America, the economic divide, I think in large part led to Donald Trump. And the impeachment itself, again, should be seen in this light because we had a president who was so unconventional because there was such deep grievance and such a hopelessness. And then coupled with that, the people who didn't vote for Donald Trump because of the hopelessness, you know, some of them also voted for him because they were afraid, although there's some overlap there between the hopeless and the afraid. They were afraid that they were losing their status somehow in America, seeing a black president. And frankly, you know, there were racist elements there.
Well, race is a segue to the next story that we considered for Story of the Year. On May 25th of 2020, Minneapolis police officers arrested George Floyd on suspicion of passing a counterfeit $20 bill at a convenience store. Minutes later, he was dead in police custody. Evelyn, what does the murder of George Floyd tell us about American society in this now third decade of the 21st century?
Well, this is interesting, Jim, because you guys are calling this a run-up to the coronavirus story. And I actually really think that what happened in the aftermath of the killing, the murder of George Floyd, the galvanization of the Black Lives Matter movement into something that was not just led by and actively pursued by Black Americans, but suddenly became something where you looked at your television screen and you saw Americans of all different races, white, Asian, all ages, in the streets saying, this can't go on. This kind of brutal killing that only happens to Black Americans has to stop. And so I think that wouldn't have happened if it weren't for your ultimate story, the coronavirus pandemic, because people had already seen through the way the pandemic unfolded how it touched Black and Brown lives unevenly because of a couple of factors. One of them, of course, being the uneven healthcare they'd received over time and continued to receive during the pandemic. Second, the fact that they were the frontline workers, the people who were required to go to work in the grocery stores, in the EMT vehicles, et cetera, people who were then being, of course, impacted and dying at greater numbers percentage-wise. And so people were upset by that. And then, of course, they had time on their hands. They were either working from home with flexible schedules or they were laid off. And so they went to the streets and demonstrated on behalf of social justice. But I do believe it was actually that run-up story is very clearly linked to your top story.
So do you think that the Black Lives Matter movement as re-energized or given new life and certainly involving millions of people with the murder of Floyd will lead to systemic changes that are necessary in this country to address the inequalities, the disparities in health and education and economic status and so forth?
Well, Wayne, I'm an optimist. I wouldn't have run for Congress if I didn't think that I could and we could all make America better. I could help my district. I could help our country. And I do believe that this movement, the fact that it's more widespread, it's more broad, it's more deeply felt, it has resulted in really more introspection among Americans who were white, who were not black, right, who hadn't been directly touched by this before. And I think that that means that the table is set, the scene is set for real systemic change. Can I say with certainty it's going to happen? No, because a lot rests on what happens in Congress and what happens in state houses. But I do believe that when the American people put their minds to it and when they want to make their society better, they can demand that of their politicians. And you can see leaders come to the fore who will bring it, you know, as we say, you know, bring it over the line. So I do think it's possible, yes. And the things that need to be done, there were things that I was already talking about and all of my co-candidates were talking about in our campaign before the May murder of George Floyd. There were things like prison reform, you know, the fact that you have so many young black men, black and brown men being incarcerated for marijuana possession. So we had already called for loosening those laws and making and decriminalizing marijuana possession and use. And we had also talked about prison reform in terms of the bail reform, not just being for New York, which we had a reform in New York so people could be let out on bail, not requiring bail, so you could be let out pending trial. And that should be something nationwide. So there are many things that we talked about that we felt involve social justice. The police reform component of it probably wasn't highlighted as much until, of course, after the murder, not just of Floyd, but of Breonna Taylor and several others.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal, and the author of 19 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Dr. Evelyn Farkas. Dr. Farkas served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Obama administration and recently ran for Congress in her home state of New York. You can find Evelyn on Twitter too, at Evelyn N. Farkas. That's EvelynNFarkas. Ev, you've worked with the U.S. Department of Defense and the U.S. military through vast stretches of your professional career. President Trump was pretty resoundingly criticized for using force on peaceful protesters in Lafayette Park. And we know from subsequent reporting that he had a desire to use active duty military in a much more aggressive fashion than ultimately played out. What's your sense, though, of the civil-military relationship coming out of that, and in particular, the role of the U.S. military in civil disturbances like we saw around the murder of George Floyd?
Yeah, I would say that this president has badly stressed the American diplomatic system, our laws. He has provoked, prodded, eroded customs. And of course, with the use of force on U.S. citizens using the National Guard there in Washington, D.C., that to my mind was something that was verging on unconstitutional. And certainly if he had called for active duty military to use force against peaceful demonstrators, that would have been unconstitutional and yet another cause for impeaching the president. The fact that the military and the Department of Defense more or less stood up to Donald Trump, I say more or less because the National Guard did take action and did you know, tear gas American citizens, you know, some of whom I know in Lafayette Square, who were really doing nothing but chanting and marching around protesting. So there were already actions that were taken by this president that are probably impeachable, but the military did more or less hold the line. And then subsequently the Secretary of Defense at the time, Mark Esper, apologized and kind of reinstated, you know, what the legal principle was, and that he wouldn't use force against the American people.
So,
go ahead, Wayne.
Let's get to the presidential election. Joe Biden won both the popular vote and also the Electoral College vote by significant margins. What does this tell us about the state of the Republic here at the end of 2020?
Yeah, well, this was a very interesting election because clearly the American people across the board, not just Democrats, but independents and Republicans, we saw, of course, a big movement with the Lincoln Project. I mean, those are more elite, educated Republicans, but they said we've got to not only vote for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but we also have to make sure that we put money behind it so that people follow us in the polls, and they also vote for the Democratic ticket. What was interesting was that there was definitely a repudiation of President Trump, but Joe Biden and Kamala Harris didn't have the coattails that people expected them to have. And what I mean by that is that in the House and the Senate races, you didn't see Republicans winning in massive numbers. In fact, there was a slight retrenchment in the House where there were some seats were lost. Democrats lost some seats. And in the Senate, we'll see what happens. Maybe in the end, these two runoff seats in Georgia will lead to a narrow, you know, swapping and of the majority. And so the Democrats will be in power again, but only very narrowly. So ultimately, I think the American people said, we still like our camps. You know, if you're a Democrat or you're a Republican, you're not switching camps really. But fundamentally, we don't want this president anymore. We don't want the noise. We don't want the disruption. And of course, many people were quite alarmed. And I think the swing voters were the people who felt that existentially there was something either for them personally at stake, you know, people who had been impacted by the coronavirus pandemic and the economic fallout from that, or people who really understand our democracy and are, like myself, were frightened to see what this president was doing to our country.
Ev, what do you see as the international reaction? How does the rest of the world view Election Day 2020 in the United States?
Well, I know to some extent because I have friends in other countries, and my, you know, WhatsApp and, you know, my text messages reflect a sense of relief. Although there were some laughing too at how long it took to finish the counts, you know, Americans can't count. And if the Americans keep counting so long, if they take so long to count, both their candidates will be gone by the time they're done. You know, kind of a joke about their age. But generally relief. Now I will say relief, but there's still a wariness. And so this is not going to be an easy job now for President, you know, elect Biden to go and work with the international community. He's going to have to regain American trust, and I don't even think it'll happen necessarily in 4 years. You know, our closest allies were really shocked at the treatment they received from Donald Trump. Every ally from Canada to Mexico, Germany, South Korea was really poorly treated by this president. And so, you know, only maybe Japan, you know, managed to avoid it only because their leader was very savvy, and Prime Minister Abe at the time was very savvy about how he treated Donald Trump.
Well, let's move from that international perspective to the global perspective and talk about the 2020 story of the year. It began really in 2019 with reports of a new pneumonia-like illness in Wuhan, China. By the middle of March, American governors were shutting down their economies, closing schools, and warning constituents of dark days ahead, even while the president of the United States vacillated in his public approach to the seriousness of the threat. After spring cases peaked, President Trump was quick to urge states to reopen their economies and to get people back to work. In the months that led up to the election of 2020, the country was a battleground for two narratives. One emphasized the risk of the virus and the failure of the Trump administration to protect both lives and the economy. The other narrative said that the worst of the pandemic was behind us and that the United States government, led by President Donald Trump, had responded magnificently. The American public rendered its judgment on those narratives in a closely contested election, even as the virus surged. As of this taping, more than 267,000 Americans have died from this virus, even as hope emerges for promising vaccines. In a year that began and ended with hotly contested politics, the story of the year is the impact of the pandemic on every aspect of American life: jobs, families, politics, communities, health, and for far too many, lives. Evelyn, you have been working in the national security community most of your adult life, and there have been warnings for years about another pandemic. When did you begin to take this particular virus seriously?
Absolutely. I mean, I actually was executive director of the Commission on the Prevention of WMD Proliferation and Terrorism, which is a long, horrible name. But one of the things we focused on back in 2008-9 was on the likelihood of a global pandemic. And of course, as we know, President Obama set up a whole office to deal with this, not just because of Ebola, but again, because of the understanding in the scientific community that SARS and these viruses would mutate. There was a high likelihood of new novel coronaviruses emerging. So this was something that was predictable in some sense. Did we know when it would happen, how it would unfold? No. And we got lucky in the past, as I mentioned, with SARS, with MERS, which was another one of these viruses. And of course, we got lucky with Ebola. But we also had very excellent management of the Ebola crisis, where we deployed to Africa, where when we had cases in the US, we isolated them, we tracked, you know, all of the things that you know you're supposed to do. So ultimately, what happened here really was a failure of government. I mean, you talk about the loss of lives. If I could just, you know, I mean, we have advanced so much from those lockdown days in March. We're now at 1,500 deaths a day, roughly a death a minute, 800 American deaths per million. And that compares abysmally to other countries. Germany has, I think it's 150 deaths per million. And the Asians are at like 20 to 30 deaths per million. So we are six times worse than the Germans and about 20 to 30 times worse than the Asians. And and I'm taking this in part from the editor-in-chief of Bloomberg, who was on, recently on National Public Radio, talking about the fact that he sees the coronavirus pandemic, at least for the United States, as being a huge indictment on our government.
So how could this happen? The United States has some of the best medical facilities and minds, the best public health people. How could it possibly have happened that we are punished, if that's the word, more severely than any other nation on earth? How could it happen, Evelyn?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Wayne, ultimately, it does come down to government, and it relates right back to what Jim was talking about earlier about the president. You know, this president failed, and the arguments, right? The argument about whether this was a serious issue and how we should approach it only appeared because the president of the United States refused to take the scientific advice of his advisors, Dr. Anthony Fauci, Dr. Deborah Birx, those very, you know, world-renowned scientists who said the way to combat this, the way to minimize the loss of life and the damage from people who are sick, you know, who recover but are still fundamentally damaged physically, is to wear masks, to you know, basically do some kind of tightening of society, to have tests across the board, across the country, and tracing. And this president refused to coordinate all of these actions to mitigate. And then when it was getting out of control, he failed to launch a concerted effort to make sure that every state that needed it, especially the states in crisis, including my state, New York, had the required personal protective equipment, the PPE, as well as the tests that they needed, the ventilators. I mean, that was a huge problem in New York, and it required a nationwide effort. The United States government could have done it, given the military, including the National Guard capabilities, the fact that we have used these for natural disasters, you know, for decades now. They're very well exercised. They can do it. We also have the Defense Production Act, which could have been used. It was used to some extent belatedly, but could have been used a lot more aggressively up front. to provide the equipment that we need. It still may end up being a problem that we haven't done it sufficiently. So there was no concerted national effort led by Washington, D.C., led by the president of the federal government. Instead, the president tried to pretend almost from the beginning as if it wasn't even an, it wasn't, it was just a regular flu. And that regular flu narrative meant that he dismissed every effort that his scientists made to alert the American people to what they had to do to protect themselves.
Ev, you make a powerful reference to the politicization of some just fundamentally basic public health measures like mask wearing. How does the new president, Joe Biden, in his first weeks in office, get his arms around responding to this in a way that isn't going to immediately become political fodder for the cable news networks and the talk shows?
I think the first thing he does is, this is not about Joe Biden, just as it wasn't about Donald Trump. So he has to use the bully pulpit, use the megaphone he has to reach all the American people. But where he has to shine the spotlight is right on the scientists. And the scientists are the ones who have to explain to the American people, and the president can reinforce exactly what's happening and what they need to do to keep themselves safe. The problem with this pandemic all along has been that the information has not been properly presented to the American people in a way that they can understand. It has not been followed up with government action to help them implement, and of course, relief. And you know, a lot of this, the problems that we've seen and the result, the impact on the election, again, goes back to the uneven impact on Americans of the pandemic. Those of us, like all of us here on the screen, who can work from home, we have, if we're careful and we listen to the scientists, we can protect ourselves. The frontline workers are the ones that we jeopardize if we're idiots and we run around without masks on, because the frontline workers are the people who are gonna have to take you to the hospital in the ambulance, who are gonna have to treat you when you're in the hospital. And then of course, there are the people in the grocery stores who are also, before you actually end up in that ambulance and you go buy your, you know, your groceries at the store, if you were reckless, then you also put them in danger. And I think the bigger rot, maybe, we have this economic, you know, and healthcare inequality in America, but I think it's exacerbated by this cultural rot of kind of indifference and callousness that the president has made acceptable somehow. That we don't have empathy for these other people, that we don't care enough about them, that we put their health at risk because we're selfish.
Ev, that is a powerful point to leave it at. Thank you for helping us take a look back at 2020 and the story of the year. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.